Welcome into this Golf Channel podcast. I'm your host, Will Gray. Pleased to be joined by Golf Channel analyst, Brandel Chambly. We're here at the Waste Management Phoenix Open, an event that is near and dear to your heart, joined by only a few hundred thousand people this weekend.
That's right.
But
half a million people.
Exactly.
It's well, growing.
Yeah, they still have to do the exact count. We'll see what the whiteboard looks like on Sunday.
My prognostication record may not be that good, but I can tell you there'll be well over half a million people here this week.
Yes, indeed. Hideki Matsuyama going for three in a row. We've got a stacked field. But before we get into that, people are still talking about what went down Sunday at Torrey Pines. And J.B. Holmes taking 4 minutes to hit his shot. Justin Thomas today in the interview room defended him, saying that he might have done the exact same thing. We've seen players on both sides of this debate come out strong. What are your thoughts, not only on the issue, but kind of on the social media firestorm that it created?
Well, I think, you know, we love reality. You know, there's a reason why reality TV shows, besides the fact that they're inexpensive to make, there's a reason why they resonate with people, you know, because they're real, hence the word. And that was a real moment. You got to see a guy, and I have no doubt that a myriad of things were running through his mind. Lots of crazy things. You know, maybe he hadn't hit whatever club it called to hit well that day or that week. Maybe he'd hit a very bad shot with it. Maybe he'd had bad experiences on that hole. Maybe he thought about the Ryder Cup or the FedEx Cup, because people who say what to that, I say, well, you're out of your mind if you don't think that things, decisions you make in January have consequences in September. Mm-hmm. Events that take place in January have consequences in September, and one of them is the Ryder Cup, and another one of them is the FedEx Cup. So all those things would have probably been coursing through his veins. And he probably, I bet you he thought it was, you know, a minute, you know.
Right.
Bet you he couldn't have told you it was 4 minutes and whatever it was, 11 seconds, mm-hmm. 4 minutes, 10 seconds. I saw Ron Cyrak tweeted that it was like 11 seconds longer than it took Bannister to run the mile, something like that. People were making all kinds of jokes about it. But it, you know, all of us and everybody watching thought it was incredibly insensitive to what was going on all around him, you know, mm-hmm. the plight of everybody else. You know, Ryan Palmer, the plight of Ryan Palmer and his group. And you know, and then he laid up.
Right.
So when he laid up, look, as an analyst, you want people to play to win, because you will hear people out here, they'll come up here and they'll sit in those chairs, and every single one of them will say, I do not play the game for money. Now, every single one of them is lying. They don't mean to lie. They don't mean to lie.
Right.
They don't. But they're playing the game for money. You know, men are, people, we're all competitive. And unfortunately, the way we keep score is how much money you make.
Right.
That's how you keep score in this game. You know, yeah, there's a score at the end of the week, and there's a score at the end of the day, but at the end of the year, okay, so they've, you know, they've come up with a system that is a different kind of currency. It's called FedEx Cup Points. But those are based upon money mm-hmm. and finishes. So money is how you keep score. And money is what everybody out here is playing for. And titles come. They'll say, win the titles, money comes. But I promise you, if there was no money, nobody would be playing here. Right? I mean, they're playing for money. So money matters. Those decisions matter. And he had all those conversations going on in his head. And that was an evidence of a man who was not playing to win. Which is, you know, it's bizarre, because you don't get that many chances to win. And nobody 20 years from now, well, because this was such a big topic, they still remember Chip Beck laid up. Maybe they'll remember JB laid up. But he had a chance to change the way he was viewed as a player with one swing of the golf club. You know, he played himself into a position where with one swing of the golf club, he could change the way he was viewed. Imagine if he had pulled a 5-iron out, which was not enough club to get there, but he towed it in and swung as hard as he could, like Gene Sarazen. Mm-hmm. Does anybody know Gene Sarazen's name outside of golf if he doesn't tow the forewood in?
Right.
And slam it in there and make it for double eagle? No, they probably don't. I mean, you know, We speak about him all the time. He's relevant for that one shot. And it wasn't a three-wood. It was a four-wood that he had towed in. So this probably wasn't a full four-iron for JB. He could have got there with a five-iron. So he could have changed with one swing of the club the way we look at him, the way we view him, and he would have entertained us. And we're all paying and sitting there to be entertained.
Well, now his response after the fact was that he felt, after looking at the various variables and the way the wind is blowing, he thought he had a better chance to hold the wedge from 50, 60, 70 yards than he would have to hold whatever pitch he would have been left with had he tried to go for it with a 5-wood or a 3-wood like Alex Noren did, who then hit it 40 yards through the green.
Right. Well, maybe he just needs – look, he needs to do the math, okay? Because at that point it becomes a mathematical equation. And he might hit – I don't even know. But he wouldn't hold anywhere near 1% of his wedge shots. There were three people that day that had hit it inside 10 feet from where he was. Three people. Cody Gribble was one of them. I'm trying to remember the other two.
Keegan, I think.
Keegan Bradley hit it in there. They hit it, you know, either from exactly 239, which was what he was, or 240, and one of them was 228. But they all, the possibility was there that they could hit it within 10 feet. And I promise you, he's got a lot better odds of holding a 10-footer than a 100-yard wedge.
Right.
So, look, if I had made that shot, if I had made that play, you're trying to argue the rationale for such a bizarre decision, yeah, maybe you throw that out there. But he knows he's wrong. He knows he does not hold. There's no way he could possibly say that or think that truly. Just no way. You're not going to hold, you know, on a good year you might hold two wedges. Mm-hmm. On a really crazy year you might hold two full wedges, you know. I promise you, from 239, he hits lots of shots inside of 30 feet. And he makes a lot more than two 30-footers a year.
It's funny you mentioned earlier the Ryder Cup and how that kind of changes people's perceptions. The way that they've changed these rules now, you don't have the fall events counting. So you get to January 1st, and now you're really in this position where you're accruing Ryder Cup points and you're thinking about Paris, even though we're 7-8 months away. We have all four majors still to play. You really feel like that has a big impact on guys' psyche and how they might approach shots coming down the stretch?
Absolutely. You know, J.B. Holmes has played in two Ryder Cups, 2008 and 2016. They won both of them. I believe that's right. The only two they've won.
Yeah. He might be the good luck charm.
He might be the good luck charm. But, you know, at the end of his career, that will be one of, you know, that's a first paragraph stuff, you know, for him. If he's riding, I played on two Ryder Cup teams, you know, three Ryder Cup teams maybe, because I, you know, he would have made enough points to get Ryder 15 by my math Sunday night, which is no, you know, if he would have come out and said, you know, I was thinking about the Ryder Cup, I was thinking about this, I wasn't thinking about, wait, I was going, oh, okay, I get that. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I get it. Mm-hmm. If you'd have won, you know, you'd have been a lot closer to the Ryder Cup. But listen, it's just golf, right? Nobody died. It was a very real thing to do, you know? I immediately started to think of when I laid up in a similar situation, and I never did that I could think of. I certainly, you know, I'm at least, you know, fairly famous for hitting a one iron off a downhill lie in a playoff over a lake trying to knock it on a green. You know, I caught an enormous amount of crap for that, but, you know, they didn't have hybrids back then. Mm-hmm. And I just hit a shot with a one iron off a side hill lie to get in the playoff over the water. would I have been better laying up? Maybe. I might have won because the guy who beat me laid up. But, you know, Ricky Fowler, we're here at the Phoenix Open, and Ricky Fowler laid up here in 2010. You know, it wasn't the last hole.
Right.
And he was either tied or one back, and he had 218.
Into 15,
218. So he only had like 190 to carry the water, 188 maybe. And it was probably a 4 or 5 iron for him. Mm-hmm. I played in the Pro-Am the next day, and I was a step or two behind where he was. And I think I got there with a 3 iron, so he could have got there with a 5 or 4. He laid up. And then he, when asked about it later, made a logical argument for not laying, you know, not going for it. But... truth of the matter is, if you put him in that spot right now, he'd go for it.
Yeah.
You just don't get that many chances to win. And, you know, winning. What did JB finish? He finished fourth.
It was a sneaky good up and down from the rough for birdie.
Well,
for like 120 grand.
You're absolutely right about that, Will, because in the melee of keeping track of Palmer and Noren and Jason Day, I didn't even see that he birdied.
Yeah.
And I can't even how he birdied, because there's no way those people were not giving him grief.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it was a sneaky good birdie for sure. But if he had gone for it and hit it in the water, people would remember. He would have learned something from it. And I'm sure he learned something from this situation.
Right.
You know?
So we're sitting here talking on January 31st, and it's amazing to think of all that has transpired already in the first full month of 2018. You have Dustin Johnson, runaway victory at Kapalua. You've got Tiger coming back. You've got Rory coming back. Jason Day in the winner's circle. All of this J.B. Holmes slow play stuff. What to you has been the biggest story of the year so far?
Tiger, you know, there's nothing that trumps Tiger's. You know,
forever and ever. Amen.
Forever and ever, until, you know, someone comes along who changes their swing almost a half a dozen times and wins 14 majors by upwards of 15 shots and animates all of us to unprecedented excitement. You know, every now and then I'll get from people, why do you show Tiger so much? And I just send the ratings to them and go, we are in the business of giving people what they want. And we also I'd like to think that we try to cast some light on what people should want.
Right.
But we also are in the business of giving people what they want. They want to watch Tiger Woods. And I'm not telling you that. That's not an opinion. It's a fact based upon the
years of data.
The eclipsing of when he plays versus when he doesn't. I just saw peripherally, took a glance at the ratings, and they were stupendous last week, and he was nowhere in sight winning, but he was on TV because people want to watch him. So Tiger Woods coming back, the possibility, I think it at least exists now, that he could come back and compete and work his way into perhaps winning. You know, it's conceivable that he could come back and win four tournaments and become the all-time leading PGA. I already think he is. But, you know, the PGA Tour argues, you know, five of Sam Snead's wins.
Team wins.
Team of,
yeah.
Whatever. Those are not individual wins. Sam Snead, in my eyes, has 77. Tiger has 79. Tiger's the leader. But he would be the indisputable leader of all-time wins on the PGA Tour if he got four more. And I think that's the best we can hope for with Tiger Woods, at least. And if he, you know, I was saying it at the PGA show, if Tiger Woods came back and won four tournaments this year, I mean, I'm a bit joking. I mean, that's hard to do. But he won five in 2013, and his swing really wasn't as good as this one. If he won four tournaments, everybody in that showroom would be worth twice as much.
Yeah.
You know, I've maintained, and I'll continue to maintain, Tiger is the most underpaid athlete in all the sport. You know, he's underpaid. You know, I don't know how to fairly compensate the guy. But he's made the PGA Tour rich. He's certainly made the Golf Channel a lot of money. He's made NBC, CBS, Yahoo, every magazine, everything that even puts a Tiger Woods story up gets a ton of traffic. Yeah. He's been a cash cow for everybody.
So you feel like the swing that he's got now and the swing that we saw last week at Torrey Pines is better than the one that we saw in 2013 when he won the Players and two WGCs and five tournaments?
Good question. I think it has potential to be better because he's healthier, and he, from what I can tell, talking to everybody that has worked with him, does work with him, is around him, he's well aware that staying centered is bad and dipping down is bad. He was not so well aware in 2013. That's, in fact, what he was trying to do, hence why he was a crappy driver of the golf ball. That golf swing is an iron golf swing. What I just described is how you hit iron shots. That's not how you hit drivers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. I mean, he was the best iron player on tour. He was 127th in strokes gained off the tee. You'll never see that sort of incongruency ever in any stats. You'll never see somebody who's the best iron player on tour. I wouldn't imagine. I'm trying to think. Maybe with Jordan Spieth. No, Jordan wouldn't be that bad.
Right.
But, I mean, especially with that clubhead speed. You know, he had 118, 19 mile an hour clubhead speed. And he was the best iron player on tour, and he was 127th in strokes gained off the tee. So what more do you need? What more evidence does anybody need to realize that that golf swing is not how you hit drivers? And so I know that he's trying to move off the ball, and he's trying to stay tall. And if he does that, well, it's game over. Mm-hmm. You know, it's game over. He'll start driving it well. It's game over. I mean, I'm convinced, honest to God, if Tiger walked out here tomorrow, I would have Tiger driving the ball straight in 2 minutes. Two minutes. Because there's no way he can't do. All he needs to do is move 3 inches to the right in his backswing. That's it. It's game over from there. He can't mess it up. But he doesn't. He stays centered, and he drops down, and he turns left. And it's like just, I mean, one bleeds into the next, which causes another problem, which causes another problem, which requires another compensation. And you'll never drive it good there. Never, never, ever. No one ever has. No one ever will. And that's where he's at. And that's where he was at in 2013. What he has now is just a hangover. He's got a hang left hangover. That's what he's got. And until he moves off the ball, he ain't going to drive it any good. He can get any driver, any technology he wants. He's not going to drive it any good. He'll still hit good irons because that's kind of how you hit good irons. But he can still putt his rear off. I'm still not convinced on the chipping. Mm-hmm. You know, even though people are like, he chipped great. I'm like, well, not really. I mean, he chipped fine. He chipped okay.
You give him a passing grade.
Passing grade, right? He chipped okay. You know, he was middle of the pack in ARG, around the green. I look at that number. How close does someone chip it? You know, cross board all week long. They measure every single chip shot. How close did he chip it? Well, he was worse than tour average. He wasn't last like he was at pretty much every other event over the last 3 or 4 years. But he was worse than tour average. So it was better, no question. It was, you know. So that was better than I thought I'd ever see him chip again. Mm-hmm. So I'll give him that.
Yeah.
And he putted as well as he's ever putted. So I'm convinced he could come back and contend and perhaps, you know, win an event or two. Because he still has, you know, the wherewithal mentally to go do those things.
What are your expectations for Rory this year, and did they change at all with how he came out of the gates, finishing third in Abu Dhabi, second in Dubai? I think he's 40 under across his first 8 competitive rounds after what he will admit was a disappointing 2017 season.
Yeah. You know, I want to wait until I see him up close. And, you know, I watched those events, and I watched the shows, and I dove into the numbers, and it looked good, and the stroke looked good, but I want to wait till I see him up close, and I can, you know, look a little bit more microscopically at things. But
you're going to get plenty of opportunity because he's playing his rear end off leading into the Masters.
Right, so. That's great. And you know, he's my favorite person in golf probably because, you know, I love his golf swing. I love the way he handles himself. He said some things that he'd probably like to take back, and then he did take them back. And he went in and apologized immediately for them. And, you know, I mean, that's what men do. That's what people do. That's what proper people do. You make a mistake, you own up to it and say, you know, I shouldn't have said that. So I've got great respect for him. I think he was injured and distracted last year. And, you know, one of the things I love about him is that he's got balance, mm-hmm. you know. And he's got balance in his life, you know, and he's happy off the golf course. So, you know, if he's not injured and he's not distracted, there's no way he finishes dead last from 125 to 150, which is where he finished last year, dead last, with a club that you get pretty much more of than any other club in the bag. You know, I think his average distance to the hole was right around that distance, and he was dead last.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't putting great. So I put that towards, look, yeah, I could find a technical problem there, but it's not always a technical problem. There's mental problems that bleed in and cause technical problems, you know. So I put that to being injured or distracted or mm-hmm. a combination of both. So it comes back and wedges it nice, and he's releasing the putter. You know, he's not dragging the butt in towards the target. You know, there's nobody else in golf besides you know, wait and see with Tiger, but I know what Rory can do, and I know what Dustin Johnson can do. And those two, playing their best, should beat everybody else.
So John Rahm finished second to DJ at Kapalua by 8 shots, and he at that point called him Superman. He said, I couldn't catch up to Superman. And he was in the interview room today saying that if he's world number two now, if I ever get to world number one, that doesn't make me Superman. That just makes me the guy that beat Superman, basically.
Wow.
How impressed are you by Rahm's rise through the rankings, and how do you see, do you feel like he is the biggest threat to Dustin Johnson in terms of the world rankings and getting to number one?
Hey, I'm incredibly impressed with John Rahm. You know, it's rare when players come along that don't require an apprenticeship. You know, even great talents like Jason Day, who when I first saw him when he came on tour, I fell out of my chair. I told my producer at Reno, 2008, 2009, I was like, pull that swing up again. Let's talk about that. I was like, I haven't seen anything like this. And it took him, you know, seven years. It's an apprenticeship. And it's generally what's required. You got to come out here and learn. Very few hit the ground running, capable of being number one in the world, major champions. Jack did. Seve did. Tiger did.
Spieth did.
And then Spieth.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Then Rory.
Yep.
Then Spieth. Now John Rahm. So you think about that. That is 55, 60 years of golf, and it took Jack, it took Seve, because that's 35 of the years. And then in the last 20 years, we've had Tiger, we've had Rory, we've had Spieth, and we have Rahm. Now, Rahm has yet to win a major championship, but I think we're all going to put him in that group. Comes out, needs no apprenticeship, is not intimidated. His game is completely fluent through every single shot. Doesn't happen very often. And those players always win majors, and they win multiple majors, and they remain good players for decades. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have in John Rahm. So sit back and enjoy the ride. It's going to be wonderful. He's got everything you need. He's got, his golf swing is just different enough that he's going to be good, right? It's not so good that people are going to want to teach him. Like, he doesn't have a teacher. You know, he sends his videos back to some Spanish instructor, and they look at him, but he doesn't have a helicopter teacher. He doesn't have somebody standing over him to remind him of things that he's not doing right, which, you know, there's a lot of teachers I love, and there's a lot about teaching I love, and I love the information, but helicopter teachers are really only there for themselves. You know, they're not doing their players a huge service. They're there to promote themselves. Mm-hmm. And it works, right? They're very famous. They become very famous. But players don't need helicopter teachers. I mean, they will say they do because you're paying for it and you want them there and you're going to argue that they're helping you, but they're really not. I'm not just saying that as an opinion. I mean, I look at the way players play who are constantly coached, and they will take more rehearsals. And think about Michelle Wee. Watch Michelle Wee when she's getting into a shot. See how many rehearsals she makes in her golf swing. How many times she'll take practice swings. How many times she will rehearse with this, that, or the other. And how long she will take to hit a shot. And you get a sense of what I'm talking about. And compare that with a John Rahm. John Rahm pulls the trigger. You know, mm-hmm. He gets in there and gets after it. Because he doesn't have any technical thoughts. There's no timidity in John Rahm. There's arrogance. And there's get out of my way, which is wonderful. And I mean that in the most wonderful way. You know, arrogance is a good thing when you're playing golf. It's not so good at dinner, but it's a wonderful thing when you're competing. You know,
right.
You have to think you're better than everybody else. And he appears to be able to say the right thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a rare combination to call Dustin Superman. And Dustin is. But when you're also competing against him, it's hard to verbalize that. It's hard to admit that you're competing against Superman. But John Rahm appears to be able to, you know, he's got the wonderful social skills, I think, and competitive skills that are just amazing to watch. His golf swing is just funky enough that no one's ever going to mess with it,
mm-hmm.
because nobody can really understand it. And that's a plus. He's having tremendous success at a young age, so that means not only does he have the success, he gets to play his entire career knowing that he's good enough. You know, he doesn't have to ever, he'll never have to chisel through doubt, you know. And most every player is chiseling through doubt before every shot. To some extent, they have scar tissue or they have timidity because they've been told they're doing this, that, or the other wrong. And he doesn't have to do that. So he's fabulous. You know, he's fabulous for the game. To watch him go at it with Rory and Dustin and Jordan and Justin and, you know, Jason and, you know,
it's a good time. It's a good time in golf.
And listen, if you're a golf fan, you've got, you know, we can go back and forth and argue, is one dominant player better than several great players? Well, we'll never see another Tiger Woods. I mean, you just, every compelling ingredient boiled, you know, just wrapped up in one player. Like, you couldn't even dream him up. But barring another Tiger Woods, to have this many nice guys, great players who are young, who are, by all accounts, pretty darn good with the media, you know, it's really good. I mean, these are Justin, Jordan, Jason, Rory, Dustin. I think Dustin's terrific with the media, you know. I think he is, you know, what I see, you know. When one of the things I love about Dustin Johnson, I challenge anybody watching or anybody listening to this podcast to find me video of Dustin Johnson throwing a club or cussing. Go find it. Good luck.
That's true.
Good luck. Good luck. I watch. And if there's anybody that deserves to yell an expletive or throw a golf club in the last 10 years, it's Dustin. Mm-hmm. The things that's happened to him in major championships boggle the mind from an inequity standpoint, from an inconvenience standpoint, from an unprecedented standpoint, from a getting screwed standpoint. And not once does he cuss, yell, raise his voice, throw a club, none of that. He just gets back in the saddle, acts like a gentleman, and goes to work. And, you know, yeah, I mean, sports is about entertainment, but really at its roots, it conveys ethics. It really does. I mean, you know, kids are watching. And that kid, Dustin Johnson, he's aware kids are watching. Mm-hmm. And so is Jordan. So is Jason. You know, Jason doesn't cuss. Jordan doesn't cuss. Dustin doesn't cuss. I've seen Rory lose his temper a few times, but I've never really heard him cuss on the air. You know? And I don't hold it against somebody throwing a club.
Right.
I've flung a few in my day.
It's cathartic if you get it right.
It is. And look, Rory throwing that three iron in the water growl gave me great pleasure. Like, I got it. Like, I got it. And I lived vicariously through him. And I've wanted to hit a hard, high cut with a three iron and knew I was going to hit it and hit it on the toe and it hooked in the water. And by God, that club deserves to be decapitated or thrown in the water. I get it. That's really cool. So I'm not criticizing that. But, you know, the F-bombs being dropped, I mean, and look, I've done that too. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to think I didn't do that on TV.
Right.
You know. So anyway, the point is, I think the world of Jon Rahm and his talent. Mm-hmm. And I would be hard-pressed to say he is the number one challenger to Dustin, because I still don't think anybody can play the type of golf that Dustin Johnson can play besides Rory McIlroy right now.
Right.
Those two, to me, are the only two that can drive. I mean, Rahm's there, but Rahm doesn't have their club head speed. You know, I don't think that Rahm can as easily work the ball as Dustin and Rory. We're splitting hairs here. But there are very nuanced reasons why I think Rory and Dustin are a titch
better, above the rest.
Above the rest. Right. Above the rest.
Fair enough. I'll let you get out of here with a couple here to close. It's a really good field this week here at TPC Scottsdale. Five of the top seven in the world rankings. Next week at Pebble, give me another good field. Jordan Spieth defending. And then we get down to Riviera with perhaps the best field of the West Coast swing. Tiger will be there. But, you know, DJ, Spieth, Justin Thomas. It's going to be a lot of really good talent at Riviera. Are you at all surprised at kind of the the strength of field that is widespread across the West Coast swing these days, I feel like it's changed.
Yes.
Even in the last 3, 4, 5 years, it has gotten stronger week to week than
yes,
what we saw before.
Yes, I am. It seemed like for a while that the best players were waiting until Florida swing. But again, it seems like the younger players have embraced the Phoenix Open and San Diego and Career Builders and AT&T. They're more social, they're more engaged, and they know all these stars that they can play with at the AT&T, and they want to come here and play in front of this crowd. And it's invigorated, it's breathed new life into these West Coast events. And also it's a Ryder Cup year, and I think, you know, the PGA Tour is clever. You know, they're very clever. They, you know, the FedEx Cup, you can get wealthy enough to where your kids' kids never have to worry again about money. You know, you can take care of your kids and your kids' kids with the money you make playing professional golf. When I played the tour, you could get wealthy, but you couldn't get, you know, stupid wealthy. I mean, these guys can
it's
make
a scientific term.
Yeah,
stupid wealthy.
Wealthy.
Yeah.
You know, you know, you could get, you know, castle on a hill wealthy playing golf now. You could get nice house in a gated community wealthy when I played the tour. But yeah, I mean, you know, so these kids, they get it. They want to be in that FedEx Cup, you know, and you know, people love to be cynical. So why are you guys talking about the FedEx Cup? It's made up by the PGA. It's like, no, it's a year-long competition that literally gets the PGA Tour players to play more events,
mm-hmm.
which is good for fans and good for the player because they're going to make a bunch of money. And in the end, when I would skip an event, it used to drive my dad nuts. You know, I wasn't a guy who played, except for my rookie year, I maybe played 29 events, but otherwise I played, I don't know, 22, 21, 23 events.
Mm-hmm.
My dad would get so mad at me. Like, what are you doing? I was like, you know, I'm tired. I want to go home. He's
right.
Like, tired of what? He was like, you know, you're not doing anything. And really, he was right, you know. I mean, yeah, I should have played more golf because you don't realize it at the time. But, you know, it's if you can get a job out here playing the tour, it's a phenomenal gig. And there's really, you know, you shouldn't be taking a lot of weeks off, and tour players don't. So we all come to the Phoenix Open, and we get this great field.
Mm-hmm.
This place is going to be crazy this week.
It will.
It's going to be crazy.
That was leads into my last question here. You're a Scottsdale guy. You've got plenty of experience with this event. For the uninitiated, those that have not made the walk out to the 16th hole or even seen just the vibe of this tournament beyond hole 16, how do you explain it to someone who hasn't been here?
Well, it's an Indy 500 crowd. It's a Super Bowl crowd. It has that kind of energy to it. It's sport loud. It's not golf loud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of volume you get here is runway loud, airplane runway loud. That's how loud it is. And it's a place to be seen. You know, this is a happening. It's not so much a golf tournament. It's a place to be seen, and it's a place to do business. You know, I mean, they wall in the 16th and 17th hole. Those are all corporate boxes. They're $175,000, $200,000, $300,000 a box. So they're doing business, and golf is the perfect vehicle for that. It's a bucket list thing to do. Like go to the Super Bowl, go to the Indy 500, go to the Phoenix Open, and see it just once. I think golf tournaments are tough to spectate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're pretty darn tough. You know, especially when you're 5'9" like me and you can't see over the crowd. This is a great event to come watch because you can get up on these hills with binoculars. You can see, you know, a host of, you know, really good players. You can get close to them. But there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. This tournament is as irreverent as the Masters is reverent. You know, it's as raucous as the Masters is peaceful. You know, the Masters is a cathedral. This is a rock concert. You know, they couldn't be any more different. You know, I always go back and forth between the Masters and the Open.
Mm-hmm.
And the Open outside of Phoenix is the British Open. We call it the Open Championship. Those are my two favorite events of the year. But this is the most fun event of the year. You know, it's just a big week-long party with a little bit of golf mixed in.
There you go. I think that's they got a new slogan there if they if they want it. But it should be an interesting week here at the Waste Management Phoenix Open. Brandel Chamblee, thank you much for joining us. I know it's going to be a busy week for you, and hopefully we can sit down and do this again here in a few weeks.
We'll
do a state of the tour and get your take on a number of topics, because I know that if we talk in 4 or 5 weeks, there's going to be a whole other set of questions to run by.
I look forward to it, Will. Enjoy your work and enjoy reading golfchannel.com. Nobody covers golf like you guys.
Well, I appreciate the plug there. So thank you much, Brandel Chamblee, for joining us. This has been the Golf Channel Podcast. I'm your host, Will Gray. We'll see you next time.